Clayton. John Clayton.
Hey, Mom! I'm done with my segment!
This is the Coors Light Cold Hard Facts with John Clayton.
Brought to you by Coors Light. Made to chill.
Time to talk some football with the professor, John Clayton, who joins us every day here with Bob, Dave, and more. Hello, John.
Hello, guys.
Hey, John, we went through a little exercise to open the show today. Jim wrote a piece that's up at 710sports.com, and he ranked the Seahawks acquisition so far. There have been eight, so he went 1 through 8. We kind of gave our own. We were all roughly the same. I think Dave and I both had Quentin Dunbar. No, Dave had Bruce Irvin number one. Jim and I both had Quentin Dunbar as their number one overall acquisition. And then we just went, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Who would you rank at the top? Who would you rank at the bottom of the acquisitions to this point?
Well, first of all, I'd kind of like to see Jim Moore exercise, because that's something that we usually don't have in picture and envision. Aww. So, like, we kind of like to see that. That would be kind of interesting. But no, I would say you'd have to put Dunbar number one, because he comes in, really was a top performing cornerback last year. Again, maybe Pro Football Focus had him too high at the number two, the second best cornerback in the league, but he's a good cornerback. So I put him number one. Then I would put Bruce Irvin number two. Then I think Brandon Shell number Greg Olsen number three. Number four would be Brandon Shell. Then BJ Finney number five. And then you fill out the rest with I would say Philip Dorsett, number six, Chance Warmack, number eight, and then Cedric Abwaye, if that's the way he pronounces his name, he would be number seven. Although it was kind of funny, because we saw he got more than the minimum. He ended up getting a one-year deal at $2.3 million, which is above the compensatory line.
Okay, so how much, how would you characterize, like, B.J. Finney, Brandon Shell, and throw Dorsett, Warmack? What kind of numbers are we looking at for those guys?
Well, I mean, blocking-wise, it's hard to put numbers on that. But, because, again, I put them, in that number 4 and 5 hole for Shell at right tackle and Finney number 5. Was that?
I meant money, like contracts.
Money?
Who's the most expensive? Yeah.
For most expensive, it would be Brandon Shell at $5.5 million. Then we still don't have Dorsett's number. We still don't have Bruce Irvin's number. That hasn't come up yet. So the most expensive, with Brandon Shell at $5.5 million, B.J. Finney coming in at $4 million. He was the second most expensive. Then we don't know Dorsett's number, but technically at the moment you could say that Cedric was probably next, but more than likely Bruce Irvin's going to top that, because it's probably going to be $4 million a year, if not a little bit more.
So, John, you think Dunbar is going to come in and be the starting right corner next year?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think it's a situation much like they did when Quandre Diggs, and I know that Dave Wyman is apprehensive about this, and naturally so, is that, you want to get Marquise Blair on the field. But if you're trying to win, and this team obviously is trying to win and win now, if Dunbar comes in, picks up the system, which he should because he's a cover one, cover three type cornerback, then I have to think that he has a decent chance to beat out Trey Flowers. Now, again, it's open competition, and so anything can happen, but I'd say, just like in the case of Diggs over Blair, that it's going to probably be Dunbar over Flowers.
Hey, John, where are you at with Shaq Griffin and how good he is? We were having a little debate with Jim where he feels like Trey Flowers probably isn't as bad as some people think, and Shaq Griffin is not as good as some people seem to think because he doesn't get interceptions. How do you view Shaq Griffin?
I mean, right now is, I think, a very good player. I mean, the fact that he went to the Pro Bowl and got Pro Bowl alternate votes and was able to slide in, I think that does say something. And so, if the players, the coaches, not even the fans, put him in a position where he's one of the top 7 or 8 cornerbacks in a conference, I think, what's that say? I mean, sure, he may not have the interceptions, but I mean, as good as Richard Sherman is, I mean, sometimes people were in quarterbacks like Colin Kaepernick were just stupid because they were kept on challenging covering him, and he's one that he's going to get the interception if you throw too many at his way. But I think Shaq Griffin has now established himself as a very good cornerback. Now, is he a top-level shutdown cornerback? No. But I think in this system, you know, he works very well. And again, I think, you know, because now you have to start to think, okay, what are you going to pay him? Clearly, I think he's at a position where you're not going to pay him the $16 plus million that a Byron Jones was going to go. But I mean, you're going to have to go into double digits to figure out how to pay him. Because then, if not, the option is you do Quentin Dunbar because his contract's up, or do you, and you know, you still have Trey Flowers there. So, you know, it still comes down to financially as this season goes on, you know, you have to make a decision now between Dunbar and Shaq Griffin to see who is the better of the two cornerbacks.
Hey, John, any news on Clay Matthews? He's coming off 8 sacks, 9 tackles for loss, a couple forced fumbles, only played in 13 games. But he's still out there. And what kind of money you think? Do you have any idea where we think he's going to land?
I think it's going to be, you know, it's not going to be totally difficult, but I think it's going to take a little bit of time, particularly now with the fact that, you know, the Physicians Association is pretty well ruled out any player getting a physical. I mean, what ends up happening now is that, you know, the contracts you're starting to see are either guys that are, I mean, not the contract negotiations, but the guys that are officially signing, they're the guys that at least were able to find a way before that Physicians Association, you know, were able to get the physical. And then the other side is that, okay, if indeed you don't have the ability to get the physical, then you can agree to a contract. Then when you report, whenever that's going to be, then you take the physicals. We're already starting to see some problems in that regard. Like, for example, Michael Brockers, agreed to a 3-year, $30 million contract, but he has some ankle problems. And at the moment, you know, Baltimore even took the tact that they were going to go ahead and, try to see if they can get Ndamukong Suh, and they weren't able to get him. But, you know, some of these deals are going to fall apart. But overall, I think that, you know, it's one where, in the case of Clay Matthews, you're a little bit older. You still like to get the physical, but I think there's going to be a kind of wait and see. In some ways, similar to, it'll be maybe a little longer than last year, but I think it's going to be a wait and see attitude.
John, Jimmy Graham spoke to Chicago media today and said, "I'm still fast. I still have the ability to make big plays." A lot of criticism of the Bears for signing Jimmy Graham. Do you believe Jimmy that he's still fast and can still make big plays?
I can believe he can make good plays. I can't believe he's fast. I mean, I haven't seen it now in the last two to three years. I mean, it's like, once he got that knee injury, I think it took away a lot of speed. And so, you know, because, I mean, all you have to do is look at his yards per catch. I mean, you know, when he was in his prime, I mean, he's a guy that's going to get downfield because former basketball player who's a great athlete, he had the speed, but I don't agree with him in seeing that, the speed was there because did you see it in Green Bay? I sure didn't.
Hey, John, I was reading a story today about Joe Montana. He did an interview with USA Today Sports, and the quote is, "I don't know what's going on inside there, but somebody made a mistake." And he was talking about the New England Patriots letting Tom Brady get away. Do you feel like they're going to ultimately look at this as a mistake?
I think so, yeah, because what you look at is that, you know, how much of Brady's drop off last year was because of the lack of weapons he was not exposed to, or was it his decline? Clearly, he's not the same quarterback. I mean, Joe Montana wasn't the same quarterback when he went to Kansas City and, you know, won a playoff game and took him deep into the playoffs. You know, he wasn't the same, but he was still good. And I agree. I mean, you know, when you look at Tom Brady and you look at the circumstance down there where he goes in with three really good weapons, and I'm sure they're going to find a way to draft a wide receiver, so after to replace Breshad Perriman, but I think it's a great situation down there. Now, are they a division-winning team? No. I think what you look at right now is that, you know, they've gone up from a team that was projecting to be like 7.5 wins or 7 wins to now 9 wins, and so I think the Brady influence is going to be good. And what you look at, and I know we talked to Mike Reese from ESPN.com about that today, is that, you know, what's going on in New England, because, you know, they've lost about 10 players. Whether it's going to be, you know, unrestricted free agency cuts, one trade, you know, they're down 10 players and they're not really bringing any other guys in. I mean, their receiving core right now is worse than it was last year because they haven't, I mean, if you believe Demir Byrd is better than, you know, anything that Philip Dorsett is, I don't agree on that one, because if that was the case, Arizona would have tried to keep Demir Byrd.
Hey, John, Drew Brees did just an awesome thing, donating $5 million to COVID-19 release, or I'm sorry, relief funds, and helping out with that, and really cool of him. But also, I want to talk about the fact that he's 40 years old and four straight Pro Bowls, and also four straight years of 70% completion or more. In the last two, 74.4. You think he's in like a little bit of a competition with Brady, where he's going to try to go as long? What's your sense for how long he wants to play?
I think what you're looking at, and you know, it's like I'm a little surprised that Phillip Rivers only signed for 1 year, but I think what you have, because I think Phillip still wants to play two more years, if not more, but he took the 1 year deal in Indianapolis. But I mean, what did both Drew Brees and Tom Brady did? They signed 2 year deals. And so, and of course, you got Ben Roethlisberger pretty much in that 2 year phase. And so all those quarterbacks, I think, are in 2 year projects. And, you know, by 2000 and, you know, what, 23, I think all four of them are going to be gone. But I do think that you're going to get another year out of Phillip Rivers past this year. But I think what it would come, because again, one thing that you can see in Breeze, when he gets into the second half of the season, his numbers do tend to drop because he's, I don't know if his arm gets fatigued or whatever it is, but he is so good and so smart. And right now, what I think is so fascinating is that, he's in the same division as Tom Brady, and he has a better team than Tampa Bay. And so now, for the first time in 17, 16 years, whatever it is, you know, Tom Brady goes in as the underdog. He's never had to have that happen for almost 1.5 decades.
Hey, John, you know Nick Shook from NFL.com?
I do not know.
Okay, well, Nick Shook, he's writing stories. He's speculating on where certain players are going to land once the dust clears here. He's got Cam Newton going to New England, Jameis Winston going to Pittsburgh, and he's got Jadeveon Clowney going to the New York Jets. Jessam and McIntyre, well, if he doesn't return to the Seahawks, that'd be a consolation prize for Jess, since that's her favorite team. But what do you think about Clowney to the Jets?
I can see him being 1 for 3. I do think there's a chance that Newton could end up in New England. I don't buy Clowney going to the Jets because for a couple reasons. And remember, I mean, if it was indeed true that the Miami Dolphins offered him $18.5 million and he turned it down, he's living up to his ideal of not wanting to go to a bad team. Okay, and I mean, the Dolphins are going to be better, but how much better? And the Jets aren't a very good team. Sorry, Jez, but that's a reality, and so I think I can't see that one happening. Newton, I think, does have a chance, and Jameis Winston to Pittsburgh, I heard that, and it's the stupidest thing I think I've heard in the last week, because first off, I go back and, I think the three of you, maybe the two or three of you can remember this. Remember when Colin Kaepernick came to town and Pete Carroll really wanted to get him on the roster. And so they sat him down, interviewed him, and, certainly made some pointed questions. It's like, are you going to be okay on, playing behind a quarterback who may not give you a chance to get on the field? And so the next day, and I think he said this cryptically and accurately, Pete says, well, I just get the feeling he wants to be a starting quarterback. All right. So that being the case, I think it's the same thing with Jameis Winston. I mean, here's a guy that envisions getting $30 million a year and he doesn't have an offer. And so, I to go to Pittsburgh, number one, he's not going to go for the minimum. Remember, they're one of the most cap-strapped teams in football, so they can't afford, even if you can do a deal close to Marcus Mariota at $8.8 million a year. So, I mean, Winston to Pittsburgh, no way.
I find it hard to believe he would talk to Pittsburgh thinking he's got a chance to start. I mean, you've got an entrenched starter there in Roethlisberger. Now, maybe it's just for a couple more years, and he's thinking, okay, I could be the starter after he's gone. But the idea that Kaepernick would come here and think he's got a chance to start over a prime Russell Wilson or Jameis Winston going to Pittsburgh thinking he's got a chance to start doesn't even make sense to me. I'd have to question what their agents are telling him.
Exactly, because you can see what the plan is in Pittsburgh. You know, Kevin Colbert's the general manager. He's on a year-to-year contract, and he's going to stay at least 2 years because that's the timetable for Ben. Ben restructured his contract and gave them cap room, and so they've made another commitment to him with a $34 million a year contract, and they basically replaced base salary with signing bonus to clear up a lot of cap room and put more cap room in the future. So they're totally committed for him, but in after two years, I think he's going to go. So he can't break what's already there. And sure, their backup quarterbacks aren't very good. I mean, Mason Rudolph struggled. You know, Duck Hodges struggled. But Winston to Pittsburgh, I mean, there is no way.
Hey, John, I don't know what you thought about last year. I don't even know if you watch Hard Knocks, but I watch it every year and love it. But the one with the Raiders was nominated for an Emmy. Did you like that one last year? Did you like that?
No, episode? I didn't, to be honest. And I'm a big fan of Hard Knocks, because what I like about Hard Knocks is that you pick up things probably you shouldn't pick up, because you pick up little, I mean, for example, I mean, you know, all of a sudden they start bringing a name of undrafted or two undrafted guys, and then you start to watch the guy play, and all of a sudden, hey, I wasn't tipped off to this guy being this good. And so now if you're a team or you're following the league, you say, hey, this guy is pretty good. I thought it was too homogenized. I mean, sure, they had Antonio Brown as one of the problems and some of the stuff like that. But, I mean, this was as watered down of a Hard Knocks as you can imagine. I mean, it certainly wasn't as good as the Cleveland Browns, where you have, you know, internal coaching strifes, where Todd Haley is, you know, I'm not going to do that to the head coach. And so it's like, it just wasn't the same.
Hey, do we know, or I'm sure everything's going to be put off, or at least we hope it's not going to be, but have they announced who is going to be the next team on Hard Knocks? Do we know yet?
No, not yet. They haven't made that decision. I think a lot of people think it's going to be the Pittsburgh Steelers. You know, and I'm sure at this stage, you know, they're not going to, I don't know, because they may wait to the owner's meeting, if there is an owner's meeting in May, to do that. But I think, you know, that's on hold right now because it's not a priority. But, you know, what it comes down to is that you have to have a team that doesn't have a new coach, which is Mike Tomlin. He's been there, hasn't been to the playoffs in the last couple years, and that's the Pittsburgh Steelers. And so they're in there battling Detroit and three other teams for the ones to get it. And, you know, naturally Pittsburgh's not going to want it, but they may have to accept it. Arizona,
John,
by the
425
way, they're willing to do it. The Cardinals are willing to do it.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that'd be fun to have Arizona as the Hard Knocks team,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
I would agree. I would think so. I think it'd be more fun than Pittsburgh, because you got, you know, DeAndre Hopkins teaming up with Larry Fitzgerald. I mean, you got Kyler Murray. You've got a coach that's a little bit different in Cliff Kingsbury, because, you know, he's more millennial than I think most other coaches in the National Football League. And I'm not saying that in a negative way, but I think Arizona would be a great choice.
Well, and John, I was just going to ask you a question from the 425. What do you think Arizona's record is going to be this year? Do you think they have a winning record?
I don't think so. I think they're going to be more of a 7-9 team. You know, I need to see what more they're going to do on defense. Certainly, I mean, it was kind of interesting today, because, you know, Cardinals ended up re-signing Marcus Gilbert at right tackle for $3.75 million. So I still think the idea is that they're, you know, they don't need to draft a wide receiver with the 8th pick, but I think that they're going to take a tackle to come in and put him on the other side of DJ Humphreys. But you know, at least in bringing Gilbert back, they have a guy who can start, but doesn't necessarily mean that he will start.
We got the professor John Clayton here with us, as we do every day. If you guys have questions, you can text them into 710-710. That's our text line. John, I was just reading a story that had quotes from Cam Newton talking about, you know, hey, all I know how to do is work. That's all I do, and they gave up on me. Talking about the Carolina Panthers. It's an interesting take from him, and I'm just wondering his injury situation, the fact that nobody can get physicals right now. It feels like it's setting up for him to be one of the last guys to get signed if somebody is going to take a chance on him, because he's had multiple injuries. You've got no idea of telling how stable anything, if the foot is stable, the shoulder, everything he's dealt with. Do you see it ending up that way?
No, I see that going. That's the way it's going to go. And honestly, when you look at the big picture, you know, this is the most honest thing I think that he said. And I think that Greg Olsen would concur, because, you know, Greg Olsen, they gave up on him, you know, because, you know, they said, well, we'll give you the ability to seek a trade. And then the next thing you know, we mutually cut you and all those different things. But in the case of Cam Newton, give them some credit for letting Olsen go early, because then he was able to get starting money, you know, $7 million a year on a one-year deal. That was at least good. But in the case of Newton, you let him go 1 week into free agency when all the jobs are pretty well taken and he can't go get a physical. So I think that was totally unfair what the Panthers did. And I think it's pretty safe to say they did give up on him.
All right, John, good question from the 253. Because of Tom Brady going to Tampa Bay, it seems like their number of primetime games are definitely going to go up. How many do you think this year?
I think at least three. I mean, the one thing is, and maybe it's going to be more than that. Now, it's going to be hard to sell, a team that's been a perennial loser for all these years to be able to be in that winning bracket. But again, Tom Brady was the most prized, and the Patriots, the most prized thing on network television. I mean, it was hard to get, if you're ESPN, to even get more than one Tom Brady game. And so, I think this could get them at least three.
Hey, John, I'm hoping the answer to this question will be Matt Patricia, but which coach is on the hottest seat this year?
Oh, there's going to be a lot. But again, I think you lead with Matt Patricia. I think that he's in the forefront. And again, what you're looking at is that you've got only five coaching changes this year. And the last time there was this few, I think it was, 2018? No, it was 2008. And there was only four coaching changes that year. John Harbaugh was able to come into the league at that time. But what ended up happening is the next year there was 11 coaching changes, because what everybody did was delay what was going to be the inevitable for coaches. And so now, I mean, you have guys Doug Marone, Matt Patricia, who leads the list. Unfortunately, I'll bring this name up, Dan Quinn. So you're going to have maybe, and of course, in the 2008 season, you had six coaches that ended up getting fired during the season. My read on this is that the first thing you have to do when they put out the schedule, and we don't know when they're going to do that, is that when are the bye weeks? Because that's when I think each bye week you're going to see a coach get fired.
John, we appreciate it. We'll do it again tomorrow.
Okay, sounds good.
There you go, the Professor John Clayton with us every single day. If you missed any of today's cold, hard facts, brought to you by Coors Light, made to chill, just download the podcast at 710sports.com. Well, in honor of what should be Major League Baseball's opening day, we're going to check in with one of the good guys out there, Tim Kirkjian, who just wrote about the best prospect he's ever seen, take a guess, Ken Griffey Jr. We'll talk about that next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Well, we should be talking about opening day, getting pumped for a Mariners season, or at least pumped about the prospects they've got that could lead them to successful seasons. But we know what's happening in the world today, so that's not a possibility. But ESPN did something cool where they asked their baseball writers to their reporters to talk about prospects they've seen over the years, the best prospects they've ever seen, with the rule being they had to have seen them in person. And we have a chance to speak to a man who wrote about the best prospect he's seen in person. He's with us now on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. That man is Tim Kirkjian, and that prospect is Ken Griffey Jr. Tim, how are you, man?
I'm well. How you guys doing?
We're hanging in there. We're hanging in there, battling our way through this thing. And just in terms of this assignment and the one stipulation being the best prospect you've ever seen, you had to have seen them in person. Was it a tough choice for you?
Not really. I mean, he was the number one overall pick in the country, and was in the big leagues at 19, and hit a home run in the same game as his dad. Turned out to be one of the greatest players I've ever seen. So it was very much in keeping. But I'll never forget him as a young kid. I could not believe how comfortable he was on a major league field in the major league clubhouse. And of course, his dad, having played for the Reds, had something to do with that. But the story that I wrote, I quoted Scott Bradley, who was on the Mariners at the time. And he said that Junior showed up, just like all the other draft choices that year, to take batting practice at the Kingdom, just to understand, look, this is your final destination right here. And Junior gets in the cage, and instead of being like nervous, like every other draft pick would be, he's carrying on a conversation with the local writers while he's hitting line drives all over the field as a guy just out of high school. So he takes a break, and then he comes back, and he just hits ball after ball into the right field bleachers for home runs, because that's how good he was. So Scott continues the story by saying the next spring, they wanted to keep him at AAA because he'd never played there before. So they said, look, he can't make the team. He's too young. He needs AAA experience. So they line him up against every difficult, nasty left-hander in the Cactus League, thinking, well, he'll fail here, and we'll have a reason to keep him home. And instead, he hit everybody, and they had no reason to send him back. And that's how Junior ended up in the big leagues as quickly as he did, and it was breathtaking to watch.
Yeah, Tim, he was just so much fun to watch. Does he have the most beautiful swing you've ever seen? I mean, it's just one of those things you just love watching.
Yes, I think you could make a case for some other guys, but I think the most beautiful, the most technically perfect, most fundamentally sound swing I've ever seen was Junior swing. And you could also go for the way he played center field, the way he did so many things. It was just so natural. It was so graceful. And again, he got some of this at birth because his dad was a big leaguer, but he figured out the rest of it on his own. And I've never seen a swing that perfect in my career.
Well, Tim, he hit 630 home runs, and I'm just wondering how many he would have hit if he hadn't been injured so often in Cincinnati. I'm sure he would have gone over 700. And, you know, I'm 62. I think you're right around the same ballpark as me, and I'm old enough to have seen Willie Mays, and I loved Willie Mays as a kid. I even dressed up as him going out for Halloween one time. And I loved him so much. But then when I saw Ken Griffey Jr., I thought, man, Kent Griffey Jr. is a little bit better than Willie Mays. Now, I don't know where you stand on that one. Do you think Willie Mays is the best player, Ken Griffey Jr., or someone else?
Well, these are difficult questions. I think Willie Mays was better than Ken Griffey Jr. because he didn't get hurt, and he played until he was 42 years old and was a great and healthy player in his late 30s. So should we punish Ken Griffey Jr. for getting hurt? Of course not. But durability is a big part of this game. Staying healthy is a big part of the game, and Willie Mays was able to do that. So if you're asking me who is a better player, I would say Willie Mays was better than Ken Griffey Jr. And yet, in their primes, there wasn't much of a difference there. It's just that Junior's prime didn't last quite as long as Willie Mays' prime lasted.
Hey, Tim, it's probably hard to answer this question, but I've always wondered, you know, Junior played with the Mariners. Mariners were not a good team. Outside of 1995, they make this tremendous run. They had a couple years of moderate success, but, you know, he's tucked away in the corner of the country here on a team that ultimately is not a great team. What do you think his image, his star power would have been like had he played for the Yankees or the Dodgers or the Cubs or one of these big market teams with the media attention? I mean, he was still a massive star, which is a huge feat considering where he was playing and the quality of the team he played for.
Right. He was a massive star and couldn't get a whole lot bigger than he was at the end. However, a catch he made at Yankee Stadium as a member of the Mariners in left center field, and the smile on that face, that was really the beginning to me of the nation starting to understand what we're looking at here. So if he made that catch, not once at Yankee Stadium, but 25 times at Yankee Stadium or something like that, yes, of course, that changes the perception. But I can tell you in my travels around the country, and whenever I mention who's the best player you've ever seen, people much younger than me, and I'm not making excuses for anyone or anything, much younger than me, say, well, Ken Griffey Jr. is the best player I've ever seen. And it's difficult to argue with that. But older guys like me who saw Henry Aaron and Roberto Clemente and Willie Mays, of course, we have a slightly different perspective. But there's a certain age group, a certain generation that thinks the best player I ever saw was Ken Griffey Jr. And it's really hard to argue that when you see a guy hitting 55 home runs and winning a gold glove the way that he did so effortlessly.
Yeah, boy, Junior, he was just unbelievable. And here in Seattle, it's been a long time. I think it's gone, 19 years now since the Mariners have been in the playoffs. Do you like what Jerry DePoto's doing, breaking everything down and playing for the future?
Yeah, he doesn't have much of a choice. Let's face it. The Astros, despite all their issues, are pretty darn good still. The A's have won 97 games 2 years in a row. And they have a young team that is pretty darn good, and it's going to stay that way at least for a few more years. And the Angels got better. So the Mariners have to look at this division and say, we're in trouble in this division. There are three teams that are clearly better than we are. And then you look around the rest of the American League with the Yankees and the Rays and the Twins, and maybe even the Indians and others, and they're teams that are way better than the Mariners right now, and that's okay. It's understandable. So when you look at that and you're realistic, you say, all right, we have to go in another direction here. This is the direction they're going, and I commend them for recognizing we're not going to the playoffs again this year, so how can we get there in 2 years from now? The best way to do that is to do a little reboot here.
Tim Kirkshen of ESPN did a very cool story on the best Major League Baseball prospect he's ever seen, Ken Griffey Jr. You can check it out at ESPN.com. Tim, thanks so much for taking time with us. We love talking to you, and hopefully we're talking again soon about a season that's actually ongoing.
I certainly hope so. Thanks, fellas. See ya.
There you go. Tim Kirkshen, one of the nice guys, one of the true nice guys out there as well. Coming
I
up,
love
we
him.
Hear about, we hear, he's great. He's great. We hear about quarantine life for Mike Leach and Quentin Dunbar and Major League pitchers. That's all coming up when we sweep the dial next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore. Sweeping the dial. Streaming everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app and 710sports.com.
Definitely watch The Tiger King. It's a documentary that's in. It's got everything.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Got everything.
It's nuts.
If it wasn't outright real, you couldn't necessarily make a movie of it exactly how it happened, because it would be too unrealistic. And now that was outstanding. I just finished that. Ozark, which if you haven't seen Ozark, you gotta see it from the beginning. That's Breaking Bad for hillbillies.
Breaking Bad for hillbillies. That's the voice of Mike Leach giving his Netflix recommendations during the stay-at-home order here. So, Tiger King, I've heard of it. I have not seen it, but I would imagine that appeals to you, Dave. I know how you love hillbillies.
Yeah, the Ozark one I have been watching, and it's kind of like a Breaking Bad, where perfectly upstanding, respectable people turn to selling drugs and money laundering, which, you know, that old chestnut. Which is always
that's
entertaining.
That's a great show.
Oh, I just yeah. recommended I'm that one to my dad, actually.
That. Yeah, it's so we've been. Season 3 comes out on Friday, actually. So, yeah, I've not. What was it? Lion King or Tiger King? What was he saying there? What was the other one?
Tiger King.
Tiger King.
Your thoughts?
It's supposed to be hard to. I think it's supposed to be hard to follow a little bit, but it sounds interesting enough to tune in. Yeah, Mike Leach on with Danny and Gallant today, and I think he also went over the SEC mascots like he did here in the Pac-12. So it's always entertaining, especially during the off season with Mike Leach, and it's going to be interesting to see how he does this year, his first year at Mississippi State.
Whether it's playing with her, playing games with her, karaoke, she got a new karaoke machine. She likes, so I can listen to her sing and things like that. So, yeah.
Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
No, I don't be on the mic. It's her. She loves Elsa, so she be singing the Elsa song. So I just
let it go.
Yeah, let it go, let it go. She's playing.
That's Quentin Dunbar talking about what his daughter does during the quarantine here. She's got a karaoke machine, and she likes that song. I have not seen the movie. I've heard that song sung by other people just in that mode right there. I don't know that I've actually heard the song itself, but I've heard other people saying, have you heard this song? And then they give you a little snippet like that.
You guys ever done karaoke? Anybody?
Oh, no. Yeah. I have. It's been a while, though.
Yeah, I did it once when I was a player with Joe Nash. I don't remember what I sang. Joe Nash, former nose guard, but he sang Mac the Knife, and he got like a standing ovation.
Really? He was good, huh?
Yeah, he was good.
That's a great song.
I go with Ain't No Sunshine. I think it's Bill Withers. I usually go with that one mainly because it's a short one. It's only like 2.5 minutes long. But I haven't done karaoke in, boy, years. It's fun, though. I'd like to do it again.
I saw a girl one time do the Immigrant Song, Led Zeppelin. That's the one with the high screaming.
Yeah.
And she brought the house down. It was phenomenal. And that, you know, you talk about choosing a difficult song. Man, it was awesome.
The most creative idea, I would say, is a weighted sock. So as long as you've got a pair of socks and we can somehow find something, you know, to weigh that sock down, and we'll effectively use duct tape because duct tape works for everything. Duct tape it to the hand and effectively keep your shoulder moving and maintain some type of laxity in the joints by just going through the throwing motion with a weighted sock in your hand that you just never get rid of. And it certainly helps to stop the seasons from building up. Certainly it's not going to enable you to stay ready to throw 120 pitches next Tuesday, but we're doing the best we can.
That sounds like a voice that used to be present on this show. That's the voice of Mariners GM Jerry DePoto talking about the most creative ideas he's seen for players to keep training during the downtime.
Yeah, until his team was compared to a Little League team. We did used to hear that voice.
Come on. No, I heard that interview this morning, and Jerry DePoto is going to be a regular guest on with Danny and Gallant.
Oh, that's cute.
Well, I know what you want to say. It's because you blew it for us, Jim, by asking him that question. And you might be right, but I'm glad that he's going to be on our station. And I enjoyed the interview this morning, and I enjoyed the anecdote that he told about the sock and how the Mariners are going through this time with the coronavirus and how they're trying to stay in shape and doing everything they can think of to help out in that regard.
Yeah, I'd imagine athletes across the board, whether we're talking baseball or NFL or even NBA, who are in the midst of their season, are trying to find creative ways to stay in shape while not working out with other people. That's got to be a pretty interesting thing if you're a football player. Obviously, there's no hitting going on. You're not in your season, but basketball players in the midst of their season, probably not playing one-on-one or playing a pickup game anywhere at this point. So. Yeah, everybody's got to get creative with how they're going to stay in shape.
Exactly. And, you know, some of the better drills that I've seen, and we heard this about DK Metcalf from Brock Heward, that he had a jugs machine, and it was firing tennis balls at him. So I thought that was really clever. There's also one where you stand like 3 feet away from a wall, and somebody behind you throws the ball, whether it's a tennis ball or whatever, off the wall, and you have to, you know, grab it. It just helps your quickness and things like that. So, yeah, there's a lot of different ways. That one I didn't quite follow, though. What was he putting in the sock?
Duct tape or something like that, or taping it to his hand?
Yeah, that was weird.
Just anything you can find to weight it down, to give it more weight.
Yeah. All right. There you go. Hey, coming up next, we're going to check in with former Seahawk and a teammate of Dave Wyman's. He will explain what the kick step, step kick, whatever it's called, is. Paul Moyer. He's going to join us next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.